Hello, and welcome to Rational Security, the Abu Baker, Bicker, Backer, whatever edition. I'm Shane Harris of The Daily Beast, and we're here without Tamara Kaufman with us.
Which
it's
means
just
the
boys' party,
out.
Which means cheers.
Cheers.
Out
we are
comes
here
the scotch.
Drinking scotch. When Tammy's away, the scotch will play. I'm here, joined this week, filling in for Tamara, our good friend Wells Bennett. Hello, Wells.
Hey, gang.
Welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
My Bloomingdale compatriot. I'm heading home after this, and maybe we can catch a ride with you.
Let's do it.
All right. And we're also here with Ben Wittes. Hello, Ben.
Hey.
Ben, who knows... This is going to be very interesting for the purposes of a podcast about the week's news, because Ben has been locked in some kind of, like, news-free, sound-free, internet-free, cave-like thing for the past 2 days. Where have you been?
I have been, for Wednesday afternoon and all day yesterday, starting quite early, in a secure, compartmentalized information facility at the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon.
Is this the new journalist Gitmo?
No, actually. So this, I was there in my as a participant in the first ever symposium or conference run by the legal advisor to the Joint Chiefs, and it was a discussion, 1.5 day discussion of a concept that the Pentagon has been throwing around recently a lot, called hybrid warfare, hybrid conflict. And so here's the conceit of the conference, which was fascinating and involved. I mean, they brought in, it's under Chatham House rules, so I can't say specifically who was there, but there were four agency general counsels there, as well as representatives of a whole bunch of allied countries in both Europe and, you know, sort of Five Eyes allies and Middle Eastern countries. So they all came to discuss this idea that the Pentagon has been, you know, has shown up in Pentagon strategy documents, that there is, you know, traditionally state-to-state conflict, and there's, you know, civil wars, what lawyers call international armed conflict and non-international armed conflict. But recently we've seen a whole bunch of what the Pentagon calls hybrid conflict. So Chinese fishing boats that are clearly sent by the Navy into the South China Sea for military purposes and kind of backed up by naval vessels. Ukrainian separatists in eastern Ukraine, mm-hmm. who are, you know, are they separatists backed by Moscow, right. or are they actually Russian troops, right, little green men?
Non-state actors, but kind of acting like states or with states.
Or at the behest of states, right? As well as
patriotic hackers in China, maybe.
Patriotic hackers in China and Russia are another example. As well as these layered conflicts like Yemen, where you have multiple state actors and non-state actors involved simultaneously, and Syria. And so the Pentagon has been throwing around this term hybrid conflict. And the question that the lawyers started sort of really struggling with and were interested in and kind of convened this symposium to discuss was, how does this map on to the legal architecture of international humanitarian law, laws of war, which sort of assume that something is either an international armed conflict or a non-international armed conflict? And so it was a really interesting sort of set of discussions that on a set of subjects that I'd really never given much thought to. I learned a lot.
And why did this have to be held in a SCIF?
Because the Pentagon's conference facilities are SCIFs. It was all at an unclassified level.
I love it. Everything was unclassified. This could have been held at Brookings, but no. Because it's at the Pentagon, every conference room is a SCIF.
And moreover, everybody needs an escort every time, you know, somebody has to go to the bathroom.
Oh, wow.
They have to be escorted.
So you couldn't check your email. You couldn't do anything like that.
I mean, there was it is not a convenient location for an unclassified conference. But it was actually completely fascinating and really interesting to get a sense of, you know, what the Pentagon clients are asking you know, what the scenarios are that the Pentagon clients are, you know, sort of asking for legal guidance on, and how that, you know, creates sort of novel issues for lawyers to think about in the IHL and non-IHL space.
Can I ask you something about that? Obviously without asking about what was said, but I suppose that if you look back at the last however many years when there's been an option for choice of law, you know, some people have complained and said, well, there's been a really opportunistic choices made by the United States, that if you don't have this much detention authority available to you in this kind of conflict, well, you analogize it to this other kind of conflict, and you say, well, we do that. Isn't one possibility, if you have a severely hybrid conflict, something very multi-layered involving a traditional civil war, a non-state actor, and then these private parties gussied up as such, even though they have the backing of a state, that you'll see more opportunistic use of international law?
Well, so, right. So one of the big fault lines in the discussion was between people who sort of hypothesized that the legal frameworks are not adequate for this problem, and people who said, wait a minute, it's really not different from anything else we've dealt with. It requires translations of principles, but those principles are still the right and really the only necessary principles. It's just a question of application of them to complex and difficult fact patterns. I think the weight, in my view, the weight of opinion was on the latter side. Mm-hmm. I tend to share it with the single caveat that I don't think cyber fits neatly into that. And I'm actually, as we speak, writing a little summary of my thoughts on the thing, which will be up on Lawfare later today.
Cool. All right. Capable of doing two things at the same time.
Well, as we speak. I'm not literally typing as we speak. I'm literally drinking some scotch as we
that's
speak.
That's definitely two things
that's,
at
that's
one time.
That's how we multitask.
I think we, we have our priorities.
That's how we multitask.
In line here on rational security. Okay, so this week on the show, Donald Trump reveals that he doesn't know the names of the heads of the world's biggest terrorist organizations. Does that disqualify him to be commander-in-chief?
Donald who?
Yeah. Who?
Who?
We've never talked about
he's
this.
He's kind of low energy.
Yeah, he really is. What a bore he is.
Yeah.
Really, yeah. Donald Trump has finally made it onto this podcast. That's how you know he has to.
We're gunning for ratings now.
Yeah, it's a tipping point.
Raytheon, keep your eyes open.
Donald
Raytheon.
Trump loves you and our podcast. Also, turns out that killing Anwar al-Awlaki was an easy decision for President Obama. We're going to talk more about that. And can the House of Representatives sue the president over the Iran deal? Plus, in Object Lessons, how our lives would be different had 9/11 never happened. So let's go with wordplay first. I will start. So Donald Trump was on the Hugh Hewitt radio program recently. Hewitt sort of quizzed him on whether or not he knew who is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And, you know, I think Trump called him like Abu Baker or something or other and the candlestick maker. Really just kind of flubbed it and really was sort of dismissive of the idea that it was important for him to know who the heads of these major terrorist organizations are, saying that he would find the right people who would not only know who those guys were, but I'm going to go out there and find, his words, the next General MacArthur who's going to go take care of them. And I think he said something of, I'm going to do the military great. I'm going to do the military better than anybody. It was an interesting...
Yeah, wait until you see when I get in there.
After he gets the Hispanic vote.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was interesting
for you. It'd be really good for, minorities and women, too.
Right.
Best ever.
So, so my question ultimately is, okay, so Donald, A, does it matter that Donald Trump does not know the names of these individuals? And with that, I also, so my other part of this question I want to pose to you guys, is A, does it matter? B, he's clearly applying business philosophy and business principles to the idea of national governance, such that I don't need to know about these things. I'll go find the people who can take care of it. Now, lots of CEOs and business people out there would say that that is not at all their philosophy to running a business. But this notion that I don't need to know particular details, I just need to know how to find the right people to do jobs. So I wonder what you guys think about this. Because aside from this sort of the carnival show of Donald Trump, he actually is pointing to a really interesting question of how much information do we really need our presidents to know about the enemies that we're fighting. What do you think, Ben?
Well, I'm old-fashioned. I think it is actually important for the president to know something. And I don't think expecting the president to know who Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is too much, given that we are, you know, at war in a meaningful kinetic sense with the Islamic State. And I also don't think it's unreasonable to expect him to know who Qasem al-Soleimani is. Mm-hmm. And now the latter may be a little bit more forgivable. We're not, after all, at war with Iran. But, you know, I think presidents have to synthesize enormous amounts of information and make complicated choices quickly, and expecting to treat that like any sort of learning curve in a, you know, in taking over a business is a very false analogy. But here's what I also think. I also think it's really important to have a president who doesn't have contempt for the question. Mm-hmm. And more than the fact that Donald Trump doesn't care about, you know, apparently doesn't know anything about the people in the region whom we're in conflict with. I think the scarier thing is that he seems to think that that's not an important thing for a president to know, because a president can simply have staff who knows who we're at war with. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, particularly if you take into account that Congress has essentially delegated to the president the ability to decide who we're at war with, the idea that the president is then delegating that further to some
unelected,
lower down people who are just kind of the right people to decide. That, by the way, was never General MacArthur's job.
Right.
You know, it was not General MacArthur's decision that we were at war with Japan. And I think that is a sort of appalling thing for somebody who wants to be president to say. By the way, on the list of appalling Donald Trump things to say, it's relatively low on the list.
Right.
But I can't see an argument for presidential ignorance of basic contours of our security situation.
It would be different too if it's not as if this is someone who has some track record of giving a damn about these sorts of things and is then asked off the cuff to name the prosecutor at the International Criminal Court or something.
Right.
This is a guy who, when you put his answer to this question alongside his answer to other questions, his whole approach to this project is the people who've run the country to date have been losers. He's a winner. The work is pretty easy. And you just need to let him do it, because you've all been a bunch of idiots for not realizing that he's the right guy to do that heretofore. So I completely agree. Yeah, he doesn't actually know who this person is, and that's bad. It'd be good if you knew who these people are that we're at war with, or I guess against whom we use lethal force or whatever. But it's all part and parcel of one big kind of proud ignorance that, at least maybe if there is some sort of other person for whom a comment like that in a certain context might not sort of send chills through your spine. But for this guy, it's just part and parcel of his own, you know, excitedness about being a total rube on just about every issue.
I like your turn of phrase, and it reminds me that we have a phrase for this in our house, which is militant ignorance. Yeah. And I think that really captures Donald Trump. And I mean, I'm with you guys. I think it's absurd that he would not know, you know, who the head of ISIS is. I mean, that really speaks to somebody who is not even like paying attention to the news. But I also think that this idea that he is putting forward, that is really the heart and soul of his campaign. I agree with you. It's that running a country, being a president, is not that hard. And he's certainly, by the way, making running for president look not that hard, because he hasn't had anything approximating the organization and the infrastructure that other candidates have spent a long time running. It may turn out to be that he's found the new model for running for president,
maybe so.
But this premise that, you know, all we have to do is apply business principles to running a country. It's, I mean, I spent the first part of my journalism career writing about the whole business of government and business-like government movement. And they're very different things. Public administration and private administration are just totally different things, down, you know, to the basic levels of the incentives that are in play, to the constituencies, to accountability.
Starting with the fact that we let businesses fail.
Exactly.
We don't, would not, you know, let a country fail. At the end of the day, the Department of Housing and Urban Development doesn't get to go out of business if it's not effective.
Right, and this is another thing he's talked about, is I'll just shut these places down. I mean, the degree to which he asserts things that he would even be able to do as president, which he would not politically and probably legally in some cases be allowed to do, also underscores the degree to which he doesn't even understand how the office to which he's running actually functions.
Yeah, this to me, it harkens back to his, this is actually from the last time he ran. Oh, this is that, well, this reminds me. It's not also as if he's Johnny come lately in this respect. He's been this gadfly in Republican primary circles for right. how, two or three cycles? I can't remember. But the last time he was doing this, the last time there was a Republican primary, you know, he was asked to explain how he would confront the Chinese about, I think it was currency devaluation. He said, you know, I would just get up on their face and say, listen, you mother, you know. As if the president of that country is going to be like, you called me a loser?
Right. As if this is the thing that no one's done yet.
Oh,
it's like,
man,
oh, we haven't tried that.
You hurt
that.
My feelings, dog.
Right.
I'm totally going to stop doing that thing with my currency, right. And I'm going to start stop spying on all your networks. My bad.
Yeah. Yeah, this, we'll wrap this up. But it also just gets to my basic question about Donald Trump, which is that, is he seriously running for president? Because these are not the statements of a serious person.
Well, except that everything that hasn't worked for anybody else, you know, everything that's been negative or disqualifying for other people has kind of helped him. And I think, you know, when you're running 30% in the polls, you're by definition seriously running for president, because, you know, time is ticking in Iowa and New Hampshire.
I mean, does he really? I mean, what I'm saying
is he believes he is awesome.
I know he believes that, but like every other person who's running, I really do think, honestly, is like, I really would love it if in the end I were elected president. I'm not so sure he has that goal at all in mind, and that this isn't just what started as a stunt and now has turned into something between a stunt and an intentional, you know, campaign.
If what you mean to suggest, he might be one of those people who projects this kind of, like, he does project this cartoon macho confidence,
yeah.
But he might be the kind who, having projected that, like, secretly goes to the bathroom and weeps because they think that someone didn't like a remark they made.
Oh, I'm sure he's
I don't think that's him.
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe he's the kind of guy who takes the oath of office and then realizes.
Yeah. Well, I think Barack Obama had that moment, too. But okay, let's go on to your wordplay, Ben. Taking out Anwar al-Awlaki, American citizen with a drone instead of trial, no problem.
Well, so
and that's for President Obama, not President Trump.
Right. So I, last week, on as my object lesson, I brought Objective Troy by Scott Shane, the new book on the Anwar al-Awlaki case. And I have since read it. And first of all, I can tell you where the name Objective Troy came from, which you had asked about last week. And it turns out that the military, when they assigned people to the kill list, gave them a name of a town in Ohio. To designate the target.
So each person got a name of a town in Ohio?
Exactly. So
why
the
Ohio?
CIA didn't bother with code names, Scott writes, but the military insisted on them. Perhaps calling them objectives, objectified them, helped distance the hunters from the human beings they were trying to kill, the way Middle Eastern males in FBI memos become MEMs, military age males. And civilian dead becomes CD for collateral damage. The military's choice of Ohio was one of the random facts that made Pentagon nomenclature so opaque. Perhaps it had even been the whim of an anonymous military planner with roots in the state. In al-Awlaki's case, the name was a little town of 25,000 in the western central part of the state,
wow.
Notable for a collection of houses made from welded steel, product of a 1930s experiment in prefabricated housing. Officials said the name was chosen at random. Al-Awlaki had become Objective Troy.
That's fascinating.
So
who is Objective Cleveland?
Dayton and Akron, too, with the Ohio rock scene.
God, Objective.
So it is, I can say this now, a truly excellent book. One of the really, really fine pieces of narrative reporting about post 9/11 American counterterrorism. You know, there are nits that I would pick with it, some of which I did in my review that I wrote on it. But basically, I think Scott's gotten a huge amount right. I learned a lot about the operation and about Alauki himself in particular, and sort of how he evolved from this moderate kind of guy who wanted to be a bridge builder between American Muslims and between America and the Muslim world, and somebody who really wanted to destroy America. And I think Scott also resolves, not 100%, but to a high degree, residual questions about whether al-Alauki was really involved in the 9/11 plot, and concludes, without quite saying, I think he really concludes that he was not, and that he genuinely was shocked by it, and that he genuinely opposed it, and ended up leaving the United States for reasons having essentially nothing to do with the FBI's investigation of him for terrorism, but with the fact that the FBI had found out that he was frequently visiting prostitutes and was afraid of kind of ruinous publicity.
Like his rep being damaged.
Exactly. And that, so his, the implication of the book is really that he didn't leave America because he radicalized. He radicalized as a result of marginalization from America. And so it's a very interesting and subtle, among other things, portrait of a person who could have gone in a lot of different directions and ended up going in this direction, a very dangerous direction, a tragic direction for, you know, the country, for himself, for his family in particular, but that there are a lot of what ifs, and this was not a person without substantial talents and who could have played a very different role in life than he ended up playing.
So does he take the view that it was not a righteous act to kill him, or a legal act? I mean,
so he doesn't really opine on whether it was the right thing to do or not. I think the implication that I get from it is that he thinks there are a lot of problems with the drone program, but notes that within the government this was sort of a matter of unanimity, that there was not a substantial dissenting view.
Hence why it was an easy call for Obama.
Obama regarded it, and Scott quotes him describing it as an easy case, and that he reports that within the interagency discussions there was essentially no dissent from it, and that the OLC opinion that was written was not really challenged by anybody, including Harold Coe.
Can I ask you something about, I've read the excerpt about the prostitution charges, and I was just going to ask you just to say a little bit more, having read the book, about, you know, the suggestion is it's really this at the root of his, you know, this is what causes at least al-Awlaki's departure from the United States and has a role in his radicalization. Obviously, there's a huge discussion underway these days. I mean, we had a piece up on the website not too long ago about the excessive use of inchoate liability statutes, for example, pushing people where you don't need to push them, and maybe that's playing a role in radicalization. There's this whole cottage industry out there countering violent extremism. Is this book suggesting that basically maybe prosecutors need to tone it down, that the FBI might need to tone it down a little bit because there are people who could play a constructive role?
So I don't think, to be fair, I don't think the FBI, you know, set out to investigate his use of prostitutes. Mm-hmm. The FBI had a legitimate reason for investigating al-Alauki, which is that he knew two of the hijackers, right? And And there was this real question about what his relationship was with, you know, to the 9/11 plot itself, and whether he was, you know, some sort of a sleeper agent. And so they ended up following him and surveilling him. They did not notice any evidence of terrorism, but he was visiting a lot of prostitutes, and they gathered information on that in the way that you would gather information, I think, on sort of anybody you had under pervasive surveillance. There was a discussion, a serious discussion, about whether to bring charges against him for transporting prostitutes across state lines. They decided it would be a weak case, that they would only be doing it to get at him, really for, you know, other reasons, and they decided not to do it. But he did find out about it, and he then got very spooked and leaves the country. Now, the implication isn't that he radicalized in response to that, but he goes to Britain, and, you know, he's then this preacher out of a job, right? He's not representing a moderate American Muslim constituency anymore. He's not getting invited to the capital, he's not being asked to do interfaith dialogue, all these things that are really moderating, disciplining presences in the United States, he's not being asked to do. But there's a real market for the angry, you know, much more radical. And so part of it, the implication is that...
Almost market pressure?
Exactly. He's sort of, over time, market pressures, the response to him in different environments kind of pushes him in different directions. And I think feeling abandoned by America, pushed out by America, may have played some role in that. It's a very subtle and supple portrait of it, of him. Scott doesn't draw any firm conclusions, but I think he makes a very powerful narrative. It's not really an argument, but the narrative arc is one that suggests that the departure from America was more cause than effect of the radicalization.
That's fascinating. I can't wait to read it. And it is out now. It's not
it is.
Early
gone. I think it's out.
All right. So we will check it out. And congrats, Scott. okay, Wells, let's turn to your wordplay.
My wordplay is a district court decision that was in the news yesterday in the case of United States House of Representatives versus Sylvia Matthews Burwell, better known as the Secretary of Health and Human Security.
Not for Donald Trump.
Amen.
Doesn't even know who she is.
Yeah, yeah. She's not doing her job well. Yeah, he's going to do. He's going to be great on human. Wait till you see him in office.
Me on Healthy Human Services.
Wait till he's going to be awesome at Health and Human Services. And the current person running it is a loser. Anyway, the House of Representatives sued.
They're losers.
Yeah, they're losers. They sued the Secretary of HHS in another Obamacare lawsuit. The question became whether people in Congress have legal standing to do that. Ordinarily, when legislators do those moves, the answer is a sort of quick and emphatic no. This district judge, Judge Collier, concluded that in this particular case, a piece of the lawsuit could go forward. What interested me about it was quickly online and just looking around, there were law professors and some people talking about what this might mean for a legislative lawsuit to kind of slow down or frustrate the final stages of the Iran deal.
So can Congress sue the president to block the Iran
deal? Yeah, I actually saw...
And are there such suits?
Oh, I mean, yeah, legislators have brought suits over time to try and muck around in foreign affairs. There's the biggest one, sort of biggest example at the top of my head is there was a suit brought by Barry Goldwater against President
no,
Carter.
No, no, no,
many,
no, but I mean,
ago.
Are there suits to stop the Iran deal?
Not that I'm aware of.
So far as I know, I don't believe so.
So this is a sort of hypothetical
thing.
This
is a hypothetical thing. But
I mean, technically, this week it only became a fact that it was going to go into play.
Yeah, so. I think they only knew it might even come to up for voting a couple of days ago, right?
Right, yeah. In the Senate. It's not going to go in the Senate, so it's a done deal.
Right. But anyway, I quickly saw this. It's just a district court opinion. It's not the law, certainly not a Supreme Court opinion. It hasn't even been blessed by the appellate court. But it was quickly sort of analyzed as a possible precedent for a lawsuit by the House against, I suppose, the president or someone in the sort of, maybe the State Department. I'm not even sure who the defendant would be. We'd have to look at it. But whether this created standing for the House to do that. I saw, you know, a couple blog posts about it. And it was just it just really interested me just because of the way the reasoning that was in this opinion. It seemed to say in so many words that when Congress complains that the president has violated a statute or, you know, used authority wrongly, the House of Representatives whole can't complain about that. But when the president does something that directly undercuts a congressional power, that creates an institutional injury which gets you into court. And I actually think that distinction is probably not terribly stable. I'm not even sure that makes sense. But in this case, it was that, if I read the case right, that there was something about appropriations. Congress had said, here, we're not giving you money for X, we're giving you this money for Y. And part of their claim was is that, I think Jack Lew, he was one of the other defendants in the case, had misused the money or sort of something like that. So that could go forward because we're not giving you the money for it. We decided not to. Then you took the money for something else, but you used the money for the
sounds like a Iran Contra.
Vaguely, yeah. It sort of had this kind of like don't mind the harbor aspect to it.
Right. would I have standing as an individual to sue the government over the Iran
Under these circumstances, no. Probably.
You have to be able to assert an individualized injury.
Right.
One that a court would be able to remedy with a legal rule.
Stopping a deal.
Right. And I don't know, I just saw this.
What if I am making tons of money off sanctions?
That's a really interesting question.
When you say making tons of money.
I don't know, let's say like the sanctions put one of my competitors out of business and, great for me, and then suddenly the sanctions get lifted and that guy's back in business and then I'm, out of business.
That's a better case than the House of Representatives.
I think that's yeah. On the merits, it's got a little more. Yeah, basically, just to spin this out, here's what I read. I read on the Volokh conspiracy, I think it was. The idea was, is if this distinction between direct frustration of, say, the appropriations power and mere misinterpretation or even violation of statutes holds up, I think it wouldn't. I think it's bogus. I think when this goes to the appellate court, they will destroy it. If it holds up, the idea then became, well, you could sue now if you were the House of Representatives because the president did not transmit these side deals that we've heard so much about, and the transmission of all the documents pertinent to the deal was the condition precedent for the beginning of the review period under the review statute. And since that hasn't happened yet, you effectively have frustrated Congress's participation in its approving, disapproving, or doing nothing about the deal, right?
Oh, I see.
The problem being that, to my mind, that is a statutory violation. So if this lawsuit, and I saw someone else wrote something along those lines too, out there, basically saying that that looks like a statutory violation. So if anyone's getting excited out there about this legal theory, it seems that they're complaining about the very thing that this decision says doesn't give you standing.
And that's before this decision gets reversed and on the other point.
Yeah, I think they probably got the printer warming up at the D.C. Circuit for this one. But
all right.
That is my wordplay.
Okay, well, that's fascinating. I would love to see somebody actually try and sue over this. They'd keep it alive.
Wouldn't get very far.
Truth be told, I'm actually sick of writing about the Iran deal, so let's not give them any ideas. Okay, why don't we move on to object lessons. Ben, you want to go first?
My object lesson in the famous rational security log rolling department is my new book. So Pietro Nivola, my now retired Brookings colleague, and I have edited a volume entitled What Would Madison Do? The Father of the Constitution Meets Modern American Politics. It's a series of essays by a group of scholars about various aspects of...
Is John Rausch in there?
John Rausch has an essay. It's a series of essays by a bunch of different scholars on a range of topics related to sort of application of Madisonian thought to modern American political system. You know, what would Madison have thought of the filibuster? What would Madison have thought of the modern educational system, of the healthcare debate? But Ritika Singh and I wrote a chapter about Madison's sort of vacillations on issues of national security and executive authority and how they kind of parallel modern America's vacillations on those areas. So this is the last chapter in the book, and it will be of some interest, I think, to a number of readers of listeners of this podcast, particularly those who are interested in early American history. Some interesting material in there about the changes that Madison went through from being an advocate of enhanced executive authority and enhanced national authority at the time of the Constitutional Convention to being a deep critic of it during the Washington and Adams administration when he saw Hamiltonianism, to being a kind of executive who tried to kind of live with a rule with a very limited conception of executive power, to finally being a wartime president who, you know, expanded, revitalized West Point and expanded the Navy, created a standing Navy really for the first time, and really built the military back up.
So what would Madison do about Iran?
I don't know.
There's not a chapter on that?
I just don't know. There it is.
Okay. What would he do about the high price of gas?
He'd cut it.
Okay. Not that it's high.
Price controls?
Sure. Madison would do everything that I think is a good idea. And nothing.
And me too.
And he would oppose everything that I think is a bad idea.
That's the way I've always felt about the founders I've really liked.
Yeah. The founders, I double dated with the founders. You know, I know what they believed.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Wells, do you have an object?
You know, I only have two of them. I really have two of them. Yeah, I don't really have an object. I have an empty glass of scotch, and I have an empty cup of coffee.
Excellent.
I think that's a perfect object for you as our guest.
I'm not sure it's a lesson.
It's not a lesson, but they're two objects. They stand before me. They bookend my day.
Yeah. They start with the coffee and end with the scotch.
That's about as profound as they go.
That's okay. It's Friday.
Right.
There we go.
Well, I have an object, and I'm actually asking you a couple of guys some questions about this. So my object, this is actually a photo. It's not the photo, but it is a copy of the photo that I've had basically sitting next to my desk, not in a prominent, like, showy kind of place, for about 14 years now. So this is the anniversary of 9/11. And this is a photo taken, I guess this is maybe actually from New Jersey, but of the two famous mm-hmm. beams of light that were going up into the sky after 9/11, after the Trade Center came down. And, you know, I keep this sort of, for me, not as a sort of patriotic symbol or anything like that, although I think it's perfectly acceptable as one as well, but kind of just as a reminder for me professionally of kind of where my career actually, I think, began. And I think it's safe to say that for me, absent the 9/11 attacks, I probably wouldn't be a journalist still. I don't know that I would have taken to journalism as a trade and as a discipline as much as I did had I not been intensely interested in the subject matter of national security, but also just by benefit of where I was working at the time and a set of circumstances, my job went from being a technology reporter to a national security reporter fairly quickly, and it was because of the 9/11 attacks, because where I was working at the time, there was nobody really covering intelligence and these new areas that were not emerging, but were suddenly, you know, important once again in a way that they had not been in the post-Cold War era, which is when I began my career as a young reporter. So it got me kind of thinking, and, you know, we always talk about, you know, how the course of history has been changed by that event. But for you guys, how do you think that your lives, professionally or personally, would have been different if 9/11 had never happened?
I mean, I don't know, counterfactual, I can tell you, like just about every, I mean, it was impossible not to be an American on that day and have your yeah. life not forever altered.
But like the course of your professional life even too.
I mean, I was part of this, a group of people that basically was, you know, exploded overnight, who responded with a big, you know, a mix of patriotism, but also an interest in the legal structures that were going to govern our response to this whole thing.
Yeah.
So I began to follow that as soon as I was, I guess, in graduate school, and I've pretty much followed it ever since.
Yeah.
In that respect, That's probably a direct line from A to B.
Would you have been a lawyer still? Or gone, I mean, I've gone to law school.
Maybe. My parents are both lawyers, but their lives and their trajectories were so different. One of them, you know, thinks being a lawyer is the best thing since sliced bread, and the other one sort of ran from the profession screaming and, yeah. you know, as a high school teacher. But, I also, just on a personal level, it was like my wife and I worked at the woman who is now my wife, and I worked together in D.C., just around the corner from the White House. We weren't married yet. We weren't even together yet. So, but, you know, we were both sort of deciding. I went to school here, and I stayed here afterwards, and we were both trying to figure out if this is some place we want to stay for the rest of our lives, and, you know, bulk of it. We both figured that out, and then the tax happened. So, I mean, it's all bound up together, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, it's impossible to imagine counterfactually, but I can see, based on what did happen, a pretty clear line.
Yeah. What about you, Ben?
So I think it's much easier for me to imagine a counterfactual, which is because I was already sort of doing my career. I was an editorial writer at the Post. I was kind of a legal affairs writer. And 9/11 turned me into a national security legal affairs writer. Mm. And I think it's, you know, I don't honestly know if I would have, I had some background in national security law before 9/11. I had done some research, some work on surveillance law in the 90s. But
so that's when you went to visit the FISA court.
Exactly. But it was not a dominant feature of my career trajectory at all. It was one sort of subfield of it. And this really pushed it forward and pushed everything else back. And you know, before 9/11, my book project, I wrote a book about the history of the Ken Starr investigation. You know, like, that seems like a long time ago now. And so I think it indelibly affected everything that I've done since. And I find it very hard to put myself back in the shoes of somebody who's just kind of generically interested in writing about law. Now I think of myself as somebody who's much more specialized, who yeah. writes about law and national security. And, you know, that's been the last 14 years.
And just, there'd be no lawfare either.
There certainly would be no lawfare.
No way.
Yeah. And, just
and no rational security.
There'd be no rational security. And this is a quick kind of wrap up on this too. Are you all, now that like, so we're all three people who were not doing anything really in national security, and now our lives are very much a part of that, and it's all because of that event. Are you surprised by the fact that 14 years on, this subject is still as central to the discussion about American life?
No, I'm no. surprised that it isn't more central to the discussion of American life. I think it's amazing how quickly we have returned to a quite normal and quite blithe ignoring of threats and series of behaviors that are as almost as complacent as the behaviors in the
And you say we, you 90s. Mean American society, not the
yeah.
government.
Correct.
Really? You feel that way?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the people, if one of the themes, I think, in this little world is that if you look at kind of the central, you know, how central are these kind of legal architecture type questions to the government, it's not as if 9/11 happened and all of a sudden we kind of all got lawyered up and statutes emerged or something.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
Especially how to characterize the conflict with extremism, how to deal with people, what forum you use for trials. You know, things like that, stuff that is much, much older than the 9/11. You know, if you look at that long history, you can probably, it starts to be kind of surprising that you see that the interest in it, at least in public, going down.
Hmm. I don't know, I guess I just think of it as something that is just like a central part of like anxiety and paranoia about being an American today. I don't know. Maybe it's because I just look at it every
single
time.
When everyone's out to get you, paranoia is just good thinking.
That's
yeah,
right.
Okay, that brings us to the end of the show. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find links to our other shows on our homepage, spaghettiontheWallProductions.com. You can follow Rational Security at RATL Security on Twitter. You can check us out on Facebook. Whenever you download the podcast from iTunes or your favorite podcasting app, please leave
Abu
us
Bakr,
a...
I'll pop the podcasting.
Yeah, Abu Bakr, the podcasting
Abu
app.
Podcasting.
This is what happens when you give Shane some scotch.
Exactly, but. And make me talk about Donald Trump. Please leave a rating and make sure to tell your friends about the podcast as well. Our editor for the podcast is Jen Howell. Our music was performed by this week by Donald Trump and Amor I'll Go Fuck Yourself.
That was lame.
No, it wasn't. That was good.
Argo.
No, Amor I'll Go Fuck Yourself. That could Argo. Be his name. That's what Donald Trump would call him.
Totally.
What's that guy, Objective Tony? I don't know who he is.
Too much scotch for these two.
Oh, that's probably true. It's Friday. On behalf of my good friends, Wells Bennett and Ben Wittes, I'm Shane Harris, and we will talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.